Hello and welcome. My name is Lieve Bonnevie and this is episode 35 from Clan of the Horses, a podcast about horses and horse people. The equestrian sport is facing rough terrain at the moment, and while it's easy to point out the problems, it is much more important to search for solutions. And that is the ambition behind today's episode, to look at possible solutions to some of the welfare challenges we are facing, both inside and outside the sport. But we're going to have a particular focus on Grand Prix dressage at international level, because we believe this is where the standard for the future of equestrian sports is set. What you're about to hear is a translated transcription of a much debated Norwegian episode published a few months ago, where I interviewed former 3-star FEI judge Hege Trulsen. It has proven very challenging to reproduce all the nuances in the original Norwegian episode. And for that, we apologize. But we do not apologize for our sincere attempt to change the sport to ensure a rising number of happy athletes in the arena in the years to come. The episode you're about to hear may prove challenging to listen to, and some details might be lost in translation. But if you hang on, we will offer concrete solutions apt to improve welfare in equestrian sports significantly in the future. I always like to start with the beginning. So, and that is in this aspect, the beginning of your judging career. So when did you first judge dressage at Grand Prix level?
Well, I became a national Grand Prix judge about 20 years ago. And some years later, Norway needed international judges. So they asked me if I would like to become that. And I became an international 3-star judge. And I was thrilled. And for some years, I judged at several international events together with many of the judges that are still active today. But 7 years ago, I decided to step down and leave the circus.
So you call it a circus?
Yes, because that's what I felt it was back then. More and more, I felt that it wasn't the rider that was in the center for the dressage judging any longer, but the judges acting like ringmasters. They were creating networks to achieve beneficial relationships that could lead them to the top of the career ladder and all the way to the Olympic game. And I felt that they were not longer focused on the classical dressage, but instead of more and more concerned that the sport should be spectacular and audience friendly. First, I would like to make a caveat that it has changed, because as mentioned, it's 7 years ago that I judged. I know that the International Dressage Officials Club are constantly working on improvements and that they are humble by much of the criticism that is present. I believe it is important that we see the overall picture when criticizing, so that the proposals we come with benefit in general instead of witch-hunting individuals, whether they are judges or riders, unless we're speaking about pure violence, of course. We must focus on the system that governs the sport, and that is what I want to talk about here. So, to become an international dressage judge and to be able to proceed through the rank system, one of the criteria involves having certain qualities as a likable person, being a good diplomat. But you also needed to have an ability to build networks, and you needed to be being willing to always follow the opinions from the judges in key positions. Worth mentioning is that some of these criteria are not written criteria, but anyhow, criteria that are practiced. I think it's about being well-liked in general. You need to be a kind of person who can represent FEI in a good way. And of course, it is important to be a good diplomat. But personally, I felt that that aspect of judging has been giving too much importance and that it hurts the objectivity needed to be a good judge.
It does sound kind of strange that networking and relationships should weigh more heavily than the ability to assess the performance of the rider while they are in the arena with the horse. I would think that it was priority number one, that you focused on the rider and the horse.
Yes, of course. While undertaking courses and exams, you have to prove your competence. But at the same time, you can't hide the fact that the value on being liked might have caused some very competent judges failed approval process or to continue their journey up through the system, primarily because they did not meet certain expectations about being a likable person that is willing to play along. And for sure, those qualities are important when you are a part of a team and not only judge as an individual. Yet, here we are having a debate over whether networking and diplomacy should take precedence over competence to assess correct riding.
Can you tell me more about how the existing system weakens judges' objectivity?
Well, there has often been a lot of criticism from riders regarding how two judges can judge the same performance so differently. Judges often defend themselves by saying that they are only judging what they can see. But that isn't entirely accurate, in my opinion, because we all see the same rider and horse. We see the same exercise at the same time. And even if the position of the judges can make a small difference, it doesn't make such a big difference. So why should there be such variation in scoring? While it's true that the positioning of judges and their attention in the moment can make a slight difference, it shouldn't account for significant discrepancies in scoring, especially when you're both sitting in the same short side of the arena. After all, you have watched the exact same ride. And you don't merely rate what you see and can observe as an individual judge. You make an assessment based on your interpretation of what you see. And this interpretation leads to your final score. And that interpretation isn't random. It's influenced by annual training courses and discussion with fellow judges after events. Over time, we've been working hard as judges to reach consensus and reduce these discrepancies. The idea is to transition away from purely subjective judgments towards more objective evaluation based on agreed upon interpretations of performances. But here's my concern. I believe there's too much influence from external connections or desired connections within the shared interpretations. Let me explain. Just like the rider strives for better results year after year to qualify for championships or international events, and if all goes well, go all the way to the Olympics. The judges also strive for a career path similar to the riders, such as being invited to judge at major events where you find the top riders, moving from two-star status all the way up to four stars, and get invited to judge at big championship, and in the end, the Olympics. There are only four-star judges who can judge at this level. And it is only the four-star judges who becomes course teachers and who get to decide who can climb further up the career ladder. And they are also the ones who maps out the terrain and decides how the interpretation should be. They are the ones who have the final say, so to speak.
So in this room of interpretation that you are talking about, is it a standard set by the four-star judges? Is that the right way to put it?
Yes, more or less. And as a new international judge, you really have very little to say. Even if you judge the same classes as the other judges, you are regarded as an apprentice and as a beginner. I remember when I became a three-star judge, what today is a two-star, then suddenly I was a beginner again. And I had nothing to say, really. even though I had Judges Grand Prix for many years before becoming an international judge. And it is in itself a good system that the international experience should count for more than the national one, and we must for sure have a ranking system. But then it is very important that the judges consist of people who themselves have a high level of competence in riding and training horses, and that they have not earned their stars just because they are good at networking.
Let me allow me to rewind a bit. When we did the Norwegian version of this episode, we talked about the fact that who is invited to judge at the big events is up to the organizer, and the organizer needs the top riders to attend. And the riders have their preferred judges. So if I become a popular judge, to follow your example here, the riders will then put pressure on the organizer to get the judges they prefer. In this case, that would namely be me.
Exactly. And the more places you can judge, and especially at these important big events where the top riders attend, the more your chances of being selected for the championship and being allowed to advance in the system increase, right? So in the system we have today, the career path of the judges depends on you being well liked as a judge. That's the way it is. And even if they claim they don't do it, many judges lose their objectivity. I don't think it's always conscious, but we are only humans. And objective judging is a hard standard to maintain. Many studies that we have been conducted about judging bias is crystal clear. Bias in judging is very hard to avoid.
So if I were a 4-star judge, it feels not only risky to judge the performance I have seen for what it is, because as we all know, even good riders and good horses can have a bad day, but giving objective marks on a poor performance from a top rider must be really challenging. Not only because it will feel like challenging an authority or a star, but because I might not even be invited to judge at the next big event then.
It is for sure a challenge daring to give a low score, although we well deserved. You don't dare come down hard enough on a mistake made by a rider that is important, right? An example is what one of my judge's colleagues said at a course I attended when I was still an active judge then. We discussed changing the score system from giving 4 different marks on general impression to reducing it to focus solely on the rider. Of course, there were different opinions, also within the panel of judges, as to whether this is a good solution or not. And in that discussion, one of my colleagues said, rather dryly, I would say, "I would like to see the judge who would dare to give Isabel Wirth a 6, because no one does."
The way you describe it, it sounds like a flawed system. If it has somehow been decided in advance that a mark like that would be forbidden.
Well, it's not forbidden.
Well, not in so many words, but if no one dares to do it, that will still put low marks off limits when you judge, you know, the best top riders.
True. But it is the system that is flawed, not necessarily the judges. We are only human beings. And when the system is set up in such a way that you are so dependent on how your judging is judged by the top riders, it is difficult to address faults you are not supposed to find in riders and horses at Grand Prix level, like riding the horse behind the vertical.
So what you're saying is that if you are a 3-star judge who wants to be a 4-star judge, give a top rider a low score, 6 or maybe even 5, the doors leading to judging the next big event or maybe even the Olympics will be closed?
Well, yes, or they will at least be harder to open, that's for sure. Especially on events when the rider in question is wanted and invited by the organizer.
Because that will also vary from event to event in relation to who is organizing it.
Yes, but we also see that in Norway, that there are riders who choose where to go based on the judges that attend. There are many riders who navigate this way.
So you're telling me that when the riders decide where to go and what World Cup event to attend, the choice of judges that, you know, the organizers have done already, that will weigh heavily in on their final decision on where to go?
Yes, it's not unusual, neither nationally nor internationally. But other circumstances are also important, of course. But let's look at the judges for now. If an important top rider or several top riders inform the organizer that if this or that judge attends, then we don't come, it is likely to affect what judges the organizer invite, isn't it? And then we often end up with a few judges who will be invited every time. And then we lose our objectivity if our own wishes and ambitions comes into play, right? And I assume the same goes for the stewards. The wishes and ambitions to be allowed to judge at the biggest events with the most important top riders will further your climb up the career ladder, right? That's the way it is. And then the judging itself is affected. And it is precisely the interpretation among the preferred judges that leads to where we are today, where the audience are confused and horse welfare is questioned. And then I must have to add that the riders must also keep that in mind, that when they are very quickly to criticize if their judges judge differently, they also criticize an objectivity that is vital to the sport. Of course, you must constantly look for and agree on what is good and what is bad. That is something judges work on all the time. But the fact that the judges are different is also an expression of the fact that there is room for freedom of speech.
I have to say, Hege, that this is really an eye-opener for me. For when you see Grand Prix dressage on international level from the outside, like I do, it can sometimes be very difficult to understand how judges navigate. But when you describe it like this, it makes so much more sense to me. Another thing I really would like to address once we're talking about this is the money. Not the money that sometimes seems to set the standard for everything that we do with our horses, but the money judges are not getting paid. Because being a judge doesn't pay that well, does it?
No, not at all. It's pure career ambitions, right? So you operate out of a combination of self-interest and a bit of idealism for the sport because you actually lose money being a judge. The upside is that you get to travel around the world, you get to know a lot of people from different countries, you get experience, you stay in nice hotels, eat good food, feel that you're a part of something bigger.
But when you describe it like that, it sounds like a childhood dream from the 50s of becoming an air hostess. You know, you get to travel around the world, you get to sleep at hotels and eat delicious food, experience new things, but the salaries are so and so.
Yes, absolutely. You get to travel and it is for sure an experience, but no, you don't really earn anything. You get around 100 euros per day to judge, and as an international judge, you have to travel a lot. Some events last almost a whole week, so that you have to be away from Tuesday to Sunday. And if you have a regular job, which a lot of us have, well, it is very difficult to travel or judge as much as you need to be able to follow the career path that you want to follow. So there are a lot of people who lose money being a judge. And as a judge in equestrian sport, you may be also be a rider. And if you have horses at home, like me, you might have to pay someone to look after them. So it's not a big business.
I guess then you must really have made up your mind to succeed as an international judge then. But it sounds a bit discouraging, I think, when it all adds up. You cannot always judge what you see, which must be hard when judging is the job. And add the fact that it can prove challenging to earn money, the money you need in order to do a proper job. It sounds like a pretty bad deal for everyone involved. I would suspect that any judge who is aiming for an international career will be very focused on being invited to the next big event. And we really need them to be focused on the performance delivered by the horse and the rider in the arena, don't we?
Clearly. It's also one of the reasons why I'm no longer a judge. And I know many judges who have the same inner struggle because we are not able to do the job we signed up for.
That is the feeling I get when we're talking about it. And it's kind of getting stronger. The feeling that good people are leaving the sport or taking a step back because the system itself no longer supports or promotes the values the Sarge is meant to represent, nor does it support real objectivity. And also, the focus on welfare is sometimes lost, and I have to say that is my main concern, that horses display so-called conflict behavior, or horses have clear signs of being very uncomfortable, and they're still given high scores, or even, sometimes, you know, they win.
Yes. Well, the problem is that we in many ways have created a culture where silence or keeping quiet is rewarded within the system. Take the Helge Strand case. Who has chaired and who has not chaired anything? Or who has come out and said that we must not attack individuals, not even when the individual in question represents a large establishment and clearly use violence against horses? Really? I know of great many judges, committee members of various equestrian associations, high-level trainers, high-level riders, who insist that we must not report these people, or who prefer to stay silent because they think talking about it damages the sport.
I'm thinking that might be true in the short run, but look where we are now and what kind of damage this culture of silence has done to the sport in the long run.
When people fear they might lose their career if they raise their voice, there is something wrong with the system itself. There are several examples of this. It is therefore only judges who already have ended their career or left the sport who dare to raise questions about these issues.
Yes, and then there is another thing that strikes me as perhaps even more problematic. And that is that a flawed system like this will result in shortcuts taken by top riders because they know, consciously or unconsciously, that they will get away with it. When I look at today's international equestrian sports, in this case dressage, many of the horses seem unfit or unprepared or have conflict behavior. And it seems almost normalized. And we must assume that this visible lack of harmony has a very negative impact on the sport. If tense horses, or horses showing obvious conflict behavior, or horses that are not in harmony with the rider at all, continuously advance in the ranking system, we have a problem that needs to be addressed. So how do we approach it to get, you know, back on track, so to speak?
Well, there have been for sure short necks and hollow backs in the past as well, which we also talked about in the Norwegian episode. But we are really not on the mark in relation to where we should be in terms of welfare and harmony. I think it is important to point out in an interview like this that there also are horses out there who belongs in the arena and who have been prepared in the proper way, and that we need to see the whole picture and lean on science when we make judgment. But yes, I do think that it is a problem that tense and inharmonious horses are rewarded as high marks as they are. But before I say something about that, I would like to say that we must not forget that the judges cannot do everything. We must be willing to admit that the judges are part of an entire system that is on a wrong track. And it must be a joint effort to do something to fix it. But of course, when it comes to horses who show obvious signs of lack in basic education, discomfort, or explicit conflict behavior in the arena, the judge has both the power and the duty to address it and give low marks. Having said that, it is a huge dilemma today that it can sometimes be difficult to distinguish between a well-educated horse and a horse that looks flashy because it's tense. The new type of dressage horses that we are breeding today has a natural gait that resembles what we call schwung or impulsion, which is a movement the horse gets when you've trained it correctly, right? Schwung or impulsion is not a natural movement, but something we aim for with the training of our horses so that they can carry us in balance. But that movement is very similar to the movement that today's dressage horses have when they get tense. So that's a dilemma. So to separate unwanted tension from the desired and harmonic gait we find in a happy athlete, we need to look for signs that gives us a reason to believe that the horse is an happy athlete and learn how to interpret that in an objective way. It is important to remember that it has been even worse before, like 10, 20 years ago, hasn't it? With even shorter necks. And with front legs unnaturally high and hind legs way behind in the extended trot, for example. For that is when it started, about 2 or even 3 decades ago. And it didn't always get punished with low marks either. But that was also a time where you often saw huge discrepancies in the judging, because not everybody failed to see the issues hidden behind extravagant gaits. But at that time, the judges got a lot of criticism for these discrepancies.
So my question really boils down to this, and it's not an easy question to answer, but how do we best move forward from here?
Well, the community of judges has really made an effort trying to create a system that is more objective to ensure that we get the correct winner. They have taken into consideration much of the criticism that they got for not judging in line with each other, and they are constantly in discussion about how to manage the different challenges they are facing, but they are clearly not strict enough today. When I started judging, basic mistakes were just not tolerated. And every time we saw a horse that was just a little bit behind the vertical or didn't have the neck as the highest point, which are both considered to be basic mistakes, you gave a 4. And if the legs were not parallel or there were no overstepping in the extended trot, then it was a 4. It was super strict.
And it makes sense that it is, and it should be super strict. You know, basic mistakes should not be taken lightly, especially at Grand Prix level. But from the looks of it, judges are no longer super strict when it comes to basic faults.
No, we are not. Now it's almost the opposite. We have changed it. The whole scale has changed. The rules or the criteria are so much more interpretable than before. And we become gentler, right? It's become more enjoyable to ride a dressage event now. It's more pedagogic. The riders are not longer slaughtered by the judges every time they enter the arena. Now, they get slaughtered on social media, but that's a different story. You really had to accept a lot of criticism as a dressage rider back then. It was difficult to reach 50%, and to get 60% was almost unthinkable. But today, it is common for everyone to get around 65 to 70%, and that we talk about as the magic limit at international events is 80%, right? It's quite pleasant and pedagogic for sure. But when you open the scale up like that, it also makes it harder to know how to evaluate what you're seeing, right? For example, we still say that a short neck is wrong and that it should not be the highest marks. But there is no maximum mark, because today you take into consideration everything else that happens in the same moments. And then you are adding everything up until you decide what mark you should give. So if everything else is good, you could end up with a high mark, even if the neck was too short, which is something that happens a lot.
And what do you think happens when the judge sees horses with short necks all the time? It becomes the new normal, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And over time, it feels so normal that you no longer recognize the short neck. Consider the scandal surrounding Charlotte Fry and Everdale a few weeks ago. She obviously had a bad day, and Everdale didn't carry himself like he usually does. but Fry was still awarded 80%. It may indicate that the judges are no longer able to detect when the neck has become too short and back too low. Or they are careful about giving a low mark, fearing that there could be discrepancies that could threaten their judging career. In either case, we have a very serious situation regarding horse welfare, because this kind of basic mistake is no longer classical dressage, nor is it healthy for the horses. A horse with short neck, low back, and long hind legs is not collected, but still tend to get high marks. Whereas if you look at the opposite, a horse with a neck that is slightly long, with the nose a little too much forward, but who is still round and carry itself in a healthy way and is in a healthy development, we tend to score it low. But horses should be long and round at first, and then as they manage to put up more and more weight on the hind legs, they become more and more uphill. And eventually, the horse manages to carry himself in a shorter but correct form. As a result, the back rises and the hind legs come further under the horse. We often see horses like that enter both Prix Saint-George, Intermediate, and sometimes also Grand Prix. But although these horses are schooled correctly, they are awarded far less points than the horses with short neck and hollow or low backs. Both have too little collection, but the one with the short neck and low back will almost always get a higher score, although the other horse is most healthy one. And this controversy is very rarely discussed, and that is a great pity.
I think it's no wonder that extravagant gaits that we see sometimes in modern dressage today is apt to blow the audience away. But I must say it bothers me that judges fail to distinguish between what is real collection and what is not.
Well, many judges lack rider competence. We have judges internationally, including Olympic judges, who have not ridden at higher level themselves. They have never felt what true collection really is. And like you say, it's very easy to get a little blinded by extravagant gaits. Gaits that resemble proper collections. That's why judging is very difficult. And also why it is important that the judges themselves have the same competence as the rider they're judging. This opinion has been voiced by people like Leif Turnblad back in 2017 and more recently by Martin Riechenhagen. But it is worrisome that you risk being banned as a judge if you express opinion like this in public. But the FEI really needs to get a better grip on and ensure that the judges actually have the riding skills needed to judge properly. They need to know and have experience of educating a Grand Prix horse and thereby know the stages that this horse goes through in the education. Because if you don't understand how to educate and ride a Grand Prix horse, you won't be able to reveal mistakes either. What we really need is that FEI steps in and encourage judges to judge according to the existing rules and regulation. And the regulations state that in order to become an international judge, you yourself must have participated in competition at minimum Prix Saint-George level. But the system is based solely on trust, and it can be tempting to bend the rules. Today we have judges who have not ridden more than low-medium level, but still operate as both 3- and 4-star judges internationally.
Really? You mean really 4 stars too?
Yes, 4 stars too.
How is that even possible? It makes no sense.
Contacts. Good contacts. Key people in the National Federation who hold a protective hand over you as a judge and help you move up the ranks so you can be a representative for your own country's federation, something that for sure adds value. And this is why we must have a strong and capable international federation. Once people are involved, emotions come into play, right? Therefore, we must agree on a system that can ensure that individual needs and ambition does not trump judge objectivity. The FEI has both an overall responsibility and also the opportunity to step in to ensure that we have a system that prevents riders from influencing who will judge at given events. And we also need to get away from a system where the same circle of judges attends at all the important events. Yes, it has value that they have, in a way, trained well together so that they know that they judge the same rider the same way. No surprises. Everything runs smooth and predictable. But what we really need is a system where the organizer or the riders themselves cannot control who will judge a given event. Otherwise, objectivity is lost.
I'm really curious too, how did we end up here? You know, with scandals like the ones we have seen in the equestrian sports today, where top riders are exposed using horrible methods to force horses to perform.
Well, I think it's all about prestige, not just for the riders, but for the judges too. But if there is anyone who has really tried to change the system in recent years, it is the judges. For example, at championships, where we used to have 5 judges, we now have 7. We have a judging panel which can adjust and see if there are any obvious mistakes. And the way of judging freestyles has been changed, where the riders have to submit some predetermined combinations. A lot has been done, but there is still plenty of room for improvement.
Talking about improvement, can we also talk about the training of young horses? I think the Danish Hellstrand documentary Operation X really illustrates another important aspect of horse welfare in equestrian sports, that violent shortcuts can be a really good business. The quicker you get a young horse ready for high-level competition, the faster you will make money. But educating Grand Prix-ready equines based on classical principles does take time. So if the goal is to have happy athletes in the arena rather than abused horses pushed through harmful shortcuts like rough use of spurs, whips or reins, the system itself must encourage it. Otherwise, it will be too tempting to take the money and run for individuals with a weak ethical compass. Unfortunately, such incidents that we have seen graphically exposed, both in the documentary Operation X, but also incident that has been reported elsewhere recently in Sweden, in US and in Canada. And the most shocking thing, perhaps, is that, you know, when you talk to people about it, everybody says that, you know, we know that this is going on. So people are not really even surprised or shocked. And I think it is crucial to stress that not every stable endorses violent methods, but, and for sure, a lot of horses in equestrian sports do enjoy good lives. Yet, whenever there is big money circulating, such malpractices are very tempting because it is good short-term business, isn't it?
Yes, that would be a very easy step to take into the right direction if the goal is to focus on horse welfare. We can just change the age limits. They were changed a few years ago, and now a horse can be 8 years old when they debut in the Grand Prix. Although there are horses who are ready for the Grand Prix at the age of 8, there are very few of them. In 99% of the cases, 8 years is way too early. But in 99% of the cases, it will unfortunately be good business. As a judge myself, I observed many young horses classes over the years. The introduction of these classes aimed to benefit breeders, making it easier for them to sell their horses and generate more revenue early. This notion is widely recognized and accepted, including by organizations like FEI and the judges. By showcasing horses at an earlier age in these classes, breeders can expedite the process of selling them. However, what's really interesting to observe is the transition the horses undergo when they mature. In my experience judging these classes, I've noticed a significant change in horses once they turn 6. While 4- and 5-year-olds typically maintain their natural balance and suppleness, many 6-year-olds exhibit signs of tension, often manifesting in a compromised walk and a short neck. Moreover, when horses progress to 7 years old, they're expected to master advanced movements like pirouettes, and flying change for every third strides, along with proper collection in Pre-St. George. It's perplexing to think that within just a year, a horse can advance through several classes, culminating in participating in the Grand Prix within 1 year. This rapid progression is, of course, very profitable. But I would also like to say it is not good horse welfare. If you see horses competing at top international level today, how old are they then? They are usually from 8 years to around 13 or 14 years old. Then they are often retired. And shortly after that, they get colic and die, right? It seems that great many dressage horses dies of some form of colic. Also, you often see a flare-up of stomach ulcers that is also caused by stress. My point is that many of the top-level horses are done of the age of 13, an age that, when I was young, used to be considered the prime time for the Grand Prix dressage horses, the age from 13 to 17. It would be very interesting to get a veterinary opinion on this, because this is something I've been thinking about for a very long time.
And I have to say, I'm in the same position. This is also one of my concerns. And it sounds so easy, like taking a very easy step in the right direction when we talk about young horses, that we demand that horses are allowed to mature before they perform at the highest levels. How realistic is it, though, that the FEI will make changes that will have such a huge effect on so many wallets?
Well, if horse welfare is important to FEI, then they should make rules that takes care of the horse welfare, right? Easy. For sure, if changes that led to increased objectivity in the judging system and ensure that young horses had more time to mature were put into place, it would affect many wallets, and it would also affect several of the riders with the highest ranking at present. But it's not as if we are lacking riders. There will always be others ready to step in, potentially with a healthier approach to developing the sport into the future. Similarly, there are no shortage of individuals eager to become judges if necessary. However, the dynamics often revolve around sponsorships. By shedding lights on the issues within the sport, it might actually attract sponsors who appreciate its integrity and welfare standards.
Yeah, and let's not forget that there are decent people everywhere. And I therefore consider it to be a huge mistake to assume that abuse goes on everywhere. I delved into this matter during an interview with Peder Fredriksson, a prominent Swedish show jumper. It was, I think, a couple of years ago. And seeking thoroughness in the work with this podcast, I spent an entire day observing his horses and a stable environment at Jönköping Horse Show in Sweden. And it was very reassuring to witness well-prepared, confident horses, cared for by attentive grooms, enjoying their roles with minimal stress and high performance. And I also interviewed the grooms and followed the horses through tacking up, warming up, competition and cool down. And it was a display of immaculate horse welfare every step of the way. So it is for sure possible. However, at the same event, I couldn't ignore the distressing sight of top-level horses exhibiting clear signs of discomfort, from dragging their teeth along metal doors to displaying conflict behavior in the warm-up arena. What's troubling is the lack of reaction to such behaviors. It seems like nobody's really taking notice. And these are recent occurrences, not distant memories. I think we need a more proactive approach, where we have stewardess who is stepping forward and address these issues and enforce proper treatment of the horses, not just in the warm-up arena. I think horses showing strong signs of discomfort in the stable should not be allowed to compete, period.
Yes, ensuring the well-being of horses should be a fundamental priority, and it shouldn't be too much to ask for adherence to basic rules and guidelines. It's about providing the horses with the respect, training, and time they deserve to thrive in the lives we offer them. Ultimately, it boils down to money, connections, and the willingness to enact positive change. If the FEI recognizes the need for improvement in the horse welfare and yet fail to act upon it, we have a clear discrepancy that needs addressing now.
So to sum it up, what would be your advice, input or thoughts aimed directly to the FEI, directly to the system that is really, you know, bottom line in charge of everything?
Well, I believe it's essential for the FEI to reassess their systems, particularly their democratical systems, which are currently failing. Despite claiming to have democratic systems allowing freedom of speech, there is a lack of platforms for open expressions. We need forums where all stakeholders in equestrian sport can voice their opinions and have meaningful dialogue, leading to democratic decisions about the future direction of the sport. This is something the federations themselves must address by involving players from all levels and roles, ensuring a risk-free environment for expression. Currently, many are afraid to speak out due to fear of consequences leading to silence or disengagement.
And let us also talk about the SLO of equestrian sports, our so-called social license to operate. The Hellstrand case has reached a European Commission, questioning riding overall. The FEI judges have internally speculated that equestrian sport may no longer be a part of the Olympics in 10 to 15 years. It is clear that action is needed urgently, not a decade from now, when it might be too late to save the sport's reputation. Based on the current sentiment, I cannot help but draw parallels to modern pentathlon's swift removal from the Olympics. It didn't take a decade. It happened within months once people realized what was going on and voiced their opinion. Given the current climate, the time to act is now.
Yes, we should have paid more attention to the toxic culture that sacrifices the welfare of our horses several years ago. From the early pressure placed on young horses to the living condition they endure. While there are undoubtedly many good people in the equestrian sport and its associations, we must confront the negative culture that has persisted for too long. It's uncomfortable, but this discomfort we're facing now is a result of ignoring these issues for years. We must address them head-on before they erupt into larger crises.
As we talked about, equestrian sport is undoubtedly big business. What if judges were paid a salary that truly reflected their efforts? Would we see any significant change then, you think?
There has been an ongoing debate on whether high wages could improve judges' quality. While increasing pay would undoubtedly professionalize their careers, enhancing their knowledge and skill set further, I believe the most crucial competency for judges lies in practical experience as riders and perhaps training experience on a certain level. And by being a professional judge, these competencies will be hard to maintain. Personally, I don't think competency is strongly tied to wage. Instead, it's more closely related to ambition. Plenty of people aspire to become judges, even when they are poorly compensated. While we do have a fair share of experts among our ranks who've ridden at the highest level, we must acknowledge that some lack the competences needed. This affects the overall direction of judging in equine sports. We need to establish a system to minimize human error and biases as much as possible, ensuring impartiality and objectivity for both athletic performances and equine welfare.
Hege, thank you ever so much for an important talk about an important subject. I extend my sincere thanks for the insightful peek behind the scenes that you've just offered. First in the Norwegian episode and now also in the English version. I feel I've gained a much deeper understanding of the inner workings of the equestrian sports, and for that I really, really thank you.
Yes, thank you. It was a good talk. Thank you so very much indeed for addressing these issues, not just in Norway, but also abroad.
You have just heard episode 35 from Clan of the Horses, a podcast about horses and horse people. And if you want to take part and contribute to the ongoing paradigm shift, please sign our petition, #LetHorsesSpeak, a new era for equestrian sports. where our goal is to give horses a voice that cannot be ignored. Clannad Horses publishes new episodes on the first Monday of the month, and it is a sister podcast from the largest podcast about horses in Norway, Hestenes Klan, that currently counts around 200 episodes and 500,000 downloads. You will find additional information about the podcasts and previous episodes on clannadhorses.com. I want to thank my composer, Fredrik Blom, the designer of the podcast visual profile, Ove Hals, my sound designer, Stig Holte, and my guest, Hege Trulsen, and last but not least, I want to thank you, dear listener, for your patience. May the horse be forever with you.